This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When Raquel Jurevich moved from Los Angeles to Raleigh 30 years ago, she noticed two things. The quality of life here was a lot better, and the Jewish community was a lot smaller. She continued the kinds of congregational and community service she'd done in California, and that included interfaith outreach activities. And here she discovered the Christian community was much less familiar with Judaism and the rich connections between the two faith traditions. Over the decades, Raquel, who is now Rabbi Jurevich, has thought deeply about those connections. She thinks a better understanding of each other's faiths can help Christians and Jews enrich their own spiritual practice. Central to Rabbi Jurevich's evolving interfaith practice is the story of a Torah scroll in Raleigh and a restored synagogue in the Czech Republic. Rabbi Raquel Jurevich is spiritual leader at Yavna, a Jewish renewal community in Raleigh, and she joins me in the studio now. Welcome. So good to have you.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Tell us this story. I want to start with the amazing story of this Czech Holocaust scroll and the journey it led you on. Tell us about it.
Certainly. Temple Beth Or, as have many other synagogues, is the guardian of a Torah scroll that is a survivor of the Shoah, of the Holocaust, in the Czech Republic. During the war years, there were something on the order of 1,600 scrolls collected ultimately in Prague.
I should stop you right here, and I should ask you to describe for us and tell us briefly what is a Torah scroll.
Oh, good question. A Torah scroll is parchment, units of parchment sewn together. The parchment is made from animal skin. The scroll is written by a scribe using ink and a quill, usually a turkey feather quill. The scroll turns out to be quite long, and it's attached to two rollers. And for reading Torah during Sabbath observance or during the weekly Torah readings, the scroll is rolled. So you roll from Genesis towards the end of Deuteronomy. So on the Torah scroll, you find the first five books of the Torah, of the entirety of Hebrew Scripture. And the scrolls that were distributed as foster children, as it were, of congregations, mostly in North America, Western Europe, some in Australia and New Zealand, a few in South America, these scrolls had survived the destruction of the Czech Jewish community and had been purchased by a philanthropist in about 1960 on behalf of the Westminster Synagogue in London, which set up a trust, the Czech Memorial Scrolls Trust, in order to care for and to find foster homes for these scrolls, as there were very few Jews left in the Czech Republic, and the remaining synagogues were supplied with the scrolls and with some of the remaining ritual objects that had not been destroyed. But there were so many more, and the communist government wanted hard currency, so they sold these scrolls, about 1,500 of them, for $30,000.
Wow. Well, how old are the scrolls themselves?
They vary in age. The one that is still at Temple Beth Or is over 200 years old. Mm. And the one that Yavna uses, which we are able to use for our worship courtesy of Heart Space Spiritual Resources, an educational foundation here in the Triangle area, is also a bit over 200 years old. The scroll at Beth Or comes from the town of Heshman of Mjestec, about 90 miles east of Prague. The scroll that Yavna uses comes from somewhere in the neighborhood of Prague. We don't know precisely which suburb.
Well, and there's an interesting story behind how the scrolls themselves were preserved. The Nazis were not very sentimental about Jewish Torah scrolls.
Hardly.
How and so tell us the story of how it is that they survived the war.
It was under the suggestion of the Jewish leadership in Prague, particularly of some museum curators, that the Nazis might want to concentrate the loot that they had taken from synagogues in Prague and have it cataloged. And so that's what was done. Unfortunately, only a couple of the people who were involved in this effort survived the war, but it made it possible for many of the ritual objects, particularly some of the very rare fabric objects, as well as all of these Torah scrolls, to survive. The conditions under which they were stored were not ideal by any means, but it was the difference between complete destruction and having, at least on in the part of these Torah scrolls, the opportunity for so many of them to continue their lives of service in communities around the world.
So they're saved from Nazi destruction. The communists in the 60s need cash. They sell them for $30,000, which sounds like a real bargain in terms of...
Absolutely.
And they make their way to London. And then, as you say, they find foster homes in synagogues
exactly.
around the world.
And the Czech Memorial Scrolls Trust, in addition to providing the scroll to congregations or educational institutions, museums, sometimes to Jewish retirement homes, their intention is that the story of these scrolls be told at least on an annual basis, and that the scrolls be used in some way in the life of the community. And that is certainly something that Yavne seeks to do, and it is certainly the custom at Beth Or to make sure that everyone in the community is aware of the presence of these scrolls in our arks and of the implications of having a scroll from a community that no longer exists.
The Jewish community no longer exists at Harman Yav Mestek. You were telling the story at Temple Beth Or and beyond as a kind of an outreach, but you had one part of that story wrong.
I did. I had looked up the history of the town and made a photocopy of all of this wonderful historical information, put it in a file folder, and immediately forgot an essential detail. I took the factoid that the Jewish community itself had been destroyed, and I extended it to the town. And so when I would meet with visiting groups, usually educational groups from the church community, and in this instance you're referring to, a group of students from Southeastern Baptist Seminary, I would say that the town itself had been destroyed and that this Torah scroll, therefore, had a particularly resonant presence in our ark as we remember all of those who were lost. And on this occasion, a young woman at the back of the group said, "Oh, no, no, the town hasn't been destroyed. I come from there." And that was, as we say in my trade, quite the gewalt.
And you did something with that. Tell us what you did.
I did indeed. This lovely young woman's name is Eliska Donatova, and she and her husband, Vladya Donat, finished their studies at Southeastern. They now run the Baptist Theological Seminary in Prelzhimov. And Eliska said, "Oh, I'm going home. I'm going to send you pictures of the synagogue that's been recently renovated in Herzmanovmiest. That's where the scroll comes from." And as soon as I saw the pictures, it was clear to me that we needed to go and visit and say thank you for the astonishing restoration and to give this scroll an opportunity to be read at least once more in its home synagogue. It appears that, based on information that I was able to look up recently, that there were three scrolls that lived in the Ark there, and two of them are in North America and one in New Zealand.
The story of the restoration of that synagogue is interesting as well, because unlike most places where either the synagogue had been destroyed and developed in another way, or perhaps turned into a museum, a kind of relic, this was a living social space in this town.
Absolutely. The inspiration for restoration was done by people in the town who had the vision to see that simply fixing it up wasn't going to be enough, that they wanted to make it a place where the community would be in and out for concerts, for community meetings. There are many, many weddings held there. They're not Jewish weddings, but they're quite lovely, and it's quite meaningful to people in the town to be able to use this lovely space, probably ironically because it isn't a church, and so they can have their secular wedding officiated by the vice mayor in this lovely, lovely space that doesn't necessarily have a particularistic religious resonance to them, but it feels beautiful to be there. As well, the town was made the beneficiary of a wonderful wonderful collection of Bohemian art of most of the 20th century in exchange for renovating the adjacent building to the synagogue, which was the Jewish Community Center. So you have an art center, you have the synagogue, which is a living gathering space for the community. They also renovated the Jewish cemetery and provide guides there and a lot of information. And they've renovated the rabbi's house, which is perpendicular to the synagogue there, right at what would have been the beginning of the ghetto, and use that for educational and social purposes and also for art exhibits, many of them with Jewish themes.
What's your interpretation of that? I mean, on the one hand, it does sound like there was a kind of respectful reverence that people of the town had. On the other hand, this is a sacred space for a people who have experienced a catastrophe in that town, and it's now being used for weddings and parties and art exhibits. Is there a way in which that is a kind of sacrilege?
By no means. By no means. I think it's an expression of a kind of longing and a deep regret. There are a small number of people who live in the town who remember friends who were taken away in their youth. There's also something very unusual about the town itself in terms of its own spiritual life, which was validated for us by the director of the Jewish Museum in Prague and the gentleman who was the head of the Jewish community in Prague, that the Hussite, which is a form of Reformed Catholic, the Catholic and the Lutheran congregations collaborate a great deal. So in this effort to revive Christian spiritual life in this particular town, the level of collaboration is unusual and very deep and extends back for many years and includes from all of these different congregations a desire, when possible, to include some Jewish learning in the mix.
We'll talk more about that and your role in it when my conversation with Rabbi Raquel Jurovics continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today I'm talking with Rabbi Raquel Jurovics, spiritual leader of Yavna, a Jewish renewal community. For many years, she was an associate rabbi at Temple Beth Or in Raleigh, which was the home to a Torah scroll taken from a Czech synagogue by the Nazis. She has now taken several trips to the scroll's original hometown, where the residents have restored the synagogue. So tell us about that trip, because you didn't go by yourself. Tell us who went with you.
Now, we were a group of 16. 15 of us were members of Beth Or, and Pastor Joe Ward, who was at that time the pastor at West Raleigh Presbyterian Church, came along. And while we were in Prague, we were met by a couple of members of Joe's congregation who came to Hirschman of Miestetz with us for the day that we spent there on that initial trip. We took the scroll to Hirschman of Miestetz on a Thursday so that we could conduct a morning worship service. Monday, Thursday, and Saturday are traditionally the days on which Torah is read. So we wanted to be there at a time when not only could we worship in that space, but also read from the scroll at an appropriate time. And we were mindful of the dramatic historical difference in the time period since the last rabbi there, Rabbi Dr. Isaac Folkman, was in that pulpit when two female Reform rabbis, well, one Reform, one Renewal, walked through the door carrying a Torah scroll and conducted worship in that space. And the difference between our service, between what had been there previously, between that ineffable place of connection between the last time Jewish voices had been lifted in that space in prayer and what happened when we began worshiping there. My colleague, Reverend Stacy Grove, who also was on this trip, noticed that when the scroll was placed back in the ark, it was as if the walls sighed, that there was this sense of completeness. And we're not 100% certain, but we believe that this was the first full Jewish worship service since the wartime in that space, even though Jewish groups from Prague sometimes come to visit, but they don't always hold worship there.
So that last service you talked about, you think happened during World War II?
As far as we'd been able to determine, but it's not always easy to get 100% accurate information. So we don't want to make a claim that we can't back up.
But what about people from the town? Were they present?
They were in surprising numbers. We knew that there would be some members of the municipal government attending and members of the local clergy. And when we arrived, there were many more townspeople than there were people in our group arriving. And they were attentive in the worship. Vladya Donat very kindly translated for us. We've subsequently created a Hebrew, Czech, English prayer book that we use when we go there so that we don't have to have constant translation of what's going on. But Vladya did that for us. And it was very moving and very rich. And then we had lunch with the municipal leadership and with the clergy leadership and began to forge relationships that extend to the present day.
What were they telling you about why they wanted to be there for this?
They wanted to feel that the Jewish heritage of their town had not completely disappeared. So that even if something happens in the synagogue that is definably Jewish ritual practice, only every so many months or every so many years, there is a reassurance there that the Jewish history of the place has not been eradicated. The care that's given not only to the synagogue complex, but also to the cemetery speaks to a deep desire to hold on to that connection. At the time that the Jewish community of Hirschman of Miestetz was rounded up by the Nazis, the relationship between the Jews and Christians in that town had been excellent for many, many, many decades, and it was a loss of friends and neighbors and co-workers.
Did you find that, though, unusual, the fact that people did not want to lose the sense of the presence of the Jewish community? In many communities where this has happened in Europe, we hear that in a sense, people want to get on with it and they want to remove from their memory that awful time, in part because of either the role they played or their inability to stop what was going on, whatever admixture of guilt and futility they may have felt. People want to put this behind them and not feel the presence of this painful past.
You're absolutely right, and you can see that in the different ways in which synagogues that have survived have been renovated and or repurposed. So in many places, they were turned into playhouses or cinemas or just shops, into commercial buildings. In some places where they've been restored, they were restored as rather passive museums. You could walk through and learn a great deal about the people who were no longer there. It was difficult to get a sense that there was any interest in rejuvenating or studying more deeply than was available on the surface in the exhibitions. In some places, for example, in a town further to the east called Turnov, there is an extraordinary young woman who is the director of the museum there, and she schedules a great deal of very thoughtful programming that is cultural and social and musical and historical, and makes it possible for people in that town to come to understand the depth of the loss of that community. What distinguishes Hirschman of Miestetz, in my experience, is precisely around the connection that the local clergy see between their efforts to revitalize Christianity and the significance of having a synagogue in their town that sometimes attracts Jewish teachers and worship leaders, members of the Jewish community from Prague. They want to make that connection deeper and richer and more ongoing.
And therein lies an interesting story. We think that, okay, the Christian community survives, but when you say Christian in a place that has survived Nazism and then 50 years of communism, what it means to be Christian is really a serious question.
It's extremely difficult. For some people, there might have been an in-home experience of somewhat private devotional life, but it wasn't all that safe to manifest one's Christian spirituality. And for people who went through those decades with no experience in terms of ritual practice or even a fundamental understanding of the core teachings of their faith, the desire to turn their spiritual yearnings into some form of Christian life is difficult. Who's going to be the model for that? And for the clergy in Herzmann of Mierstetz, I think that they individually have a very strong sense of the challenge there in helping people figure out, well, what does it mean to live a consciously Christian life after so many years of religious suppression? And the Czech Republic is noted for the numbers of people who, upon being introduced to you, will say, hello, my name is Jan, I'm an atheist. This seems to be a very important part of the identity, and I believe some of that has to do with the history of the church, in particular the Catholic Church, in the Czech lands, and the closeness of the church and the political governance, which wasn't always as wholesome as it could have been in terms of the lives of the population in general. So there's a lot of skepticism about the role of religion generally.
What is it they tell you that they think they can gain from you and from Judaism in recovering this religious practice?
I think that they have noticed, in a way that is certainly being manifested in many other places, that we see this happening also in the U.S. as well, that there is something about Christianity that feels deracinated if you don't have a sense of how Christianity's roots go deeply into Judaism. And so having these three clergy, actually four, the Hussite priest and her husband are both ordained in their tradition, trying to figure out how to enrich the spiritual life in a place full of people who have grown up thinking that atheism is about their only rational life choice, not being able to tie their Christianity to the Jewish community that lived side by side with them in this town since the 15th century is akin to losing their connection to Judaism as a spiritual resource. And so we found a tremendous openness to Jewish learning, and we were able to, on the last three of the trips that we made, we were able to organize interfaith healing services that allowed people to get a feel for the depth of their own Christian sentiment, but also have a close personal encounter with Torah as a source of healing revelation.
And all of these conversations and connections helped crystallize your thinking about some ideas that you had been working with for some time. Tell us about that.
For many, many years prior to this trip, I had a deep orientation to what my spiritual teacher, Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi, and Matthew Fox both called deep ecumenism, this sense that while remaining rooted in one's own tradition, there is much to be learned from studying other traditions and being aware of the different ways in which divinity manifests itself, how diverse God's ways of reaching out to us are on this planet. And I had been blessed to be in very deep conversation around these topics, both with Reverend Stacy Grove and with Pastor Joe Ward, prior to the first trip to the Czech Republic. And those conversations only deepened after our experiences there. And over the intervening couple of years, Joe and Stacy and I designed a program we called Shared Spiritual Leadership, which is particularly directed at making a powerful transformative shift in the relationship between Judaism and Christianity. My congregation, Yavne, certainly takes deep ecumenism as a given. We worship in an exclusively Jewish fashion, and we are open to participation by anyone who wishes to be part of a Jewish spiritual environment and also to give us some insight into their own traditions, practices, even though those are not the practices of our worship. But for shared spiritual leadership, what we designed was a roughly 20-week program, a combination of seminar, large group, small group discussion, and five sessions of group spiritual direction that are calculated to help the Jews and Christians who participate come to respect the authenticity and spiritual gifts of their sister tradition. There is such a problematic history between Judaism and Christianity for 2,000 years. We know what happens if we allow the casual embedded anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish teaching that can be found in Christianity to become part of the social and political fabric. We see that if you find yourself at places like Auschwitz or Terezin or Sobibor. But Judaism also needs to take responsibility for not learning enough, particularly in modern times, about Christianity and about the gifts of the Spirit that Christianity brings into the world, so that for many Jews, all we know is what we learn from popular culture, which I'm reasonably sure is not what Jesus would care for us to know about the Christian tradition.
And what's interesting about this ecumenism is that, or ecumenism, is that it is not about sort of creating one pantheistic or universal religion. Mm-hmm. It's about respecting each tradition, worshiping as a Jew, worshiping as a Lutheran, worshiping as a Catholic, but understanding more deeply what's happening in those faiths and respecting those traditions for what they are.
Precisely. I'm somewhat widely known as the cockroach rabbi, because I like to say if God didn't value diversity, there would be no reason for 3,500 species of cockroach on the planet. I think that the very nature of creation as we experience it, and the variety of faith paths that are made available to us, are testimony to God's willingness to manifest however needed in order to provide a path for everyone. There is no percentage in our denigrating one another. Not only do we miss great spiritual beauties, but we also, I think, deeply offend the source of everything. And for the community at Yavne, being open to the participation of people from different faith communities, having some study opportunities brought to us by the leadership of other communities, being housed in the beautiful sanctuary at St. Mark's Episcopal Church, for which we are most grateful, and doing some study with them and exchanging learning with that community, with the rector, Lorraine Lundgren, and my offering some teaching within that congregation. It means a great deal in terms of having a more open heart, not just to what else is out there, but also to the richness within your own tradition.
What's wonderful about your cockroach cosmology, if I may, is that I think it gets at one of the great weaknesses of multiculturalism and tolerance, tolerance in particular, as though all we can honor is what is the same in us, and finding those similarities is the kind of holy grail. When in fact, and then tolerance suggests that there's something wrong with the differences.
Absolutely.
So, okay, we'll just kind of turn a blind eye to those things. Well, what you're saying is, no, those differences are glorious. They are the abundance of creation, and they are very different, and you may not even agree. And that's the beauty of it.
That's the divinity in it. The case. The attitude of tolerance, it seems to me, leads us to doing no more than exchanging tokens of similarity. So I'll tell you, oh, hi, I'm a monotheist. And you'll say, oh, yippee, me too. And that's terrific. That's useful information, particularly for people outside of the Christian community who are confused by the Trinity, not to mention people within the Christian community who are confused by the Trinity. Still, tolerance doesn't lead you to wisdom. I'm much more interested in how do we differ, and what can I learn that might lead me even deeper into my own faith by understanding a bit better the nature of the relationship that a devout Muslim feels to divinity. What's the difference between that Muslim sense of submission and the sense of emunah, of faithfulness, that my tradition encourages me to cultivate, a faithfulness, an emunah that is reciprocal between God and human beings. So everything that you can find out about a difference gives you a gateway not only into an alternative way of understanding our relationship with divinity, but also a different way of understanding our particularistic practices and why they are so worthy of being honored and integrated into our lives.
What's going on now in that Czech town that was the home of your scroll with regard to this kind of thing, that kind of conversation? Is it going on, and do you see manifestations change as a result?
I think there's a yearning for something to be made permanent in a programmatic way that hasn't evolved yet, and we're still looking for ways to help them do that. But there are often programs in what they call the double house that have Jewish themes. There are educational programs within the Czech Republic, some of which are used in the schools in Heršovice Městec, that encourage students to learn more deeply about the Shoah by learning the details of the lives of particular families from their locality. But in terms of the kind of a multi-faith educational center or place for encounter, for very deep encounter, that some of the people in the town aspire to, we're not there yet, but we are still hopeful of being able to make that happen.
We're going to take a break right now and then find out what you have learned from all of this when our conversation with Rabbi Raquel Jurevics continues on the State of Things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Rabbi Raquel Jurevics, the leader of Yavna, a Jewish renewal community, a community that you became connected with in 2010. You left Temple Beth Or in 2010 for Yavna. Tell us about it, about Yavna.
Yavna is the only Jewish renewal congregation in eastern North Carolina. There's another congregation, I believe, in Concord, over towards Charlotte. We are affiliated with Aleph, which is the umbrella organization for Jewish renewal. The orientation for Jewish renewal has to do with responding to the cataclysm of the Shoah in a very intentional way, in looking back towards the choices that were made after the fall of the Second Temple by the rabbinic community then, the community that made a transformation between a worship system that was centered on a single shrine to synagogue worship, to home observance, to a daily practice of following the commandments, the mitzvot, that allowed for Judaism to survive and evolve over the intervening 2,000 years. We intentionally called ourselves Yavna because Yavna was one of those primary centers of rabbinic learning and teaching that allowed for the survival of Judaism and the reformulation of what it meant to live life now as a Jew as opposed to as an Israelite in Roman Palestine. After the Shoah, after this destruction of Jewish life and the many other paradigm shifts of the decades since the 40s, 50s, 60s in our social and technological and political lives, the leaders of the Jewish Renewal Movement have encouraged us to look for, well, where is the growing edge of the spiritual life of the Jewish people likely to find itself in the coming 100, 200 years on into how the faith will be transformed as a result of what we've experienced. We draw much inspiration from the mystical tradition, particularly as transmitted through the Hasidic masters. Renewal is an egalitarian form of Judaism with deep roots in traditional ritual practice, but an openness towards leadership and participation by everyone who is drawn into the orbit of Jewish learning.
And I don't think people outside the Jewish tradition and perhaps within the Jewish tradition, but certainly outside, appreciate the enormous, first of all, catastrophe of the destruction of the temple and what that meant to Jewish identity. And then the enormous amount of creativity it takes to remain somehow faithful to a deep spiritual idea and practice in ways that are going to have to be completely different now that this destruction has taken place. That takes enormous creativity over thousands of years.
It does, and we have much to be thankful for in terms of the insights and the systematic practices of analysis and creativity that the early rabbis put in place for us. So the system of Jewish law, which is called halakha, which means the path, that itself evolved as a way to account for changes over historical time so that you could remain true to the revelation in the written Torah, but guided by that oral Torah, by the conversations, the argumentation, the learning of living teachers in every generation, so that we don't have to abandon our roots to discover new ways of living out the intentionalities of that initial revelation and respond in ways that are wholesome and creative and, to my mind, ever more open-hearted to the circumstances that we find ourselves in.
That kind of response, and perhaps survival itself, it seems to me, wouldn't even be possible if you looked at your text as something that had one and only one meaning and was written millennia ago and meant what it meant then and still means that today. It would be impossible to survive if that was the approach that you took.
Absolutely. I think there is a great genius in recognizing very early on that the text in and of itself would be an inadequate guide to the details of living fully as an Israelite and certainly as a member of the Jewish community in later centuries. And so we have had for a very long time a notion that there is much more teaching to be found in the white spaces between the letters and the words and the units of thought in Torah. And we look at what's on the Torah scroll as an inspiration to interpretation, an invitation from God to find ever more revelation within the text. It doesn't mean you can ever not pay attention to what you find on the surface. And at the same time, particularly in those places where you read it and you say, oh my goodness, what am I going to do with this? Do I really even want to worship a divinity who would say such a thing? Is figure out what that might be leading you to understand, perhaps in terms of human nature and our evolutionary capacity to reframe how we relate to other people. When someone complains to me about this or that verse of Torah, I tell them that's fine. Don't like it, but do something with it.
And how do we avoid a kind of moral relativism that allows us to do whatever we'd like with it?
We do that by having a systematic process by which we draw conclusions about the way in which religious practice will change over time. So it's not an exceedingly rapid process, but it is one in which the arc bends slowly but absolutely bends towards justice, as Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King taught us. We do have to understand that we're responsible for making a space in our lives for Torah to live and for understanding ourselves in our own life stories as manifesting Torah. One of my favorite verses is one in which the Israelites are told, look, you don't have to send somebody far away to tell you what this means. The entirety of revelation is held within you. It's in your mouth and in your heart that you may do it. And I believe that holds the key to a vibrant and curious and lively and evolutionary Judaism.
And a conversation, as you said, if you broaden that to now include Christian ministers and others, it seems to me that becomes a very robust conversation about what this text means to all of us, particularly in these times when many members of Christian faiths feel that they're in a kind of, in the midst of a catastrophe, that the meaning of Christianity mm-hmm. and their system of belief is now under attack. You could provide an awful lot of wisdom to communities like that who are worried about what it means and their identity in these times.
Certainly the Shoah presented a spiritual crisis not just for Judaism but also for Christianity.
And you should remind us again the Shoah.
Shoah is a Hebrew word that means catastrophe, disaster, destruction. Holocaust is a wholly consumed sacred offering, and to suggest that those 6 million deaths, much less the additional millions of people who died during the Second World War, somehow served a holy purpose, I find unacceptable, and many people prefer the use of Shoah to Holocaust. Nobody was being offered up on an altar for a holy purpose, but rather people were being destroyed because of their faith or because they were political dissidents or because they were homosexuals or because they were disabled. The list went on and on. I think that for both Judaism and Christianity, there is a deep need to pay attention to the Shoah as a revelatory event. It's something that I learned from Rabbi Irving Greenberg and also from Reb Zalman, from my teacher Reb Zalman, and from Christian writers such as Clark Williamson who look at the aftermath of the Shoah and realize that certain givens of our respective faiths get called into question when we look at that kind of destruction and recognize either our victimhood or our responsibility. And that can be very painful. This cuts in so many different ways. I think, too, that for Jews and Christians both to have a deeper understanding of the degree to which the teachings of Jesus derive from Hebrew scripture, the way in which Jesus taught from and reformulated as part of that conversation that was already ongoing within rabbinic circles around what does it mean to lead a fully Jewish life. And even with the transformation into a Christian path in addition to the Jewish path, the Jewish roots of Christianity simply must be not just acknowledged but understood more deeply so that the resonances between the faiths are clearer. I don't think that's the same thing as saying that Judaism and Christianity have the same mission in spiritual terms, but I do think that we could evolve to a place where we were supportive of each other's authentic mission and be partners in bringing redemption to the world rather than wasting energy on denigrating one another or living in ignorance.
Or feeling that it's necessary to come up with one brand new religion that everybody celebrates. It's the idea that we can all be practicing our own religions with this deeper
Absolutely.
Understanding. And I wonder in a practical sense if you can take us back to that town in the Czech Republic that I don't dare pronounce but will leave to you. Have you met with the people who remember and who had neighbors who were lost to them, and what stories do they tell?
There are two instances in particular. One of the women who works as a docent for the synagogue complex does remember coming home from school one day, and her next-door neighbor, her duplex neighbor family, they were just gone. Another instance was meeting, I seem to have a long run of docents in my experience in the Czech Republic, the docent at the castle in Pardubice, who looked to be a woman in her mid to late 70s, who, when she learned I was a rabbi, broke down in tears, held both my hands, and through an interpreter explained to me how horrible it was for her to see all her childhood friends and their families congregated in the main square at Pardubice, which is the town where folks from the surrounding villages near Hashmet of Mestets were brought for deportation to Terezin. And that she had carried this burden for all of the intervening decades and felt somehow responsible and grief-stricken, even though she was a very small child, but that memory was indelible. In Hershman of Mestets itself, I think that there's less a sense that I and my colleagues have found there of guilt as much as a longing for reconnection. So that I don't think anybody there has a sense that there was some way that they could have done better in resisting the Nazis, but rather that the profundity of the loss their community suffered is still before their eyes, and they would like somehow to take some steps to repair that.
You have obviously thought very deeply about these things and are a very careful practitioner of your faith, and yet you have only been a rabbi for 10 years. What drew you to that, and why did you suddenly – what? It may not have been suddenly.
Suddenly,
it may
yes.
have been a lifelong decision that came
yes.
to fruition 10 years ago. Tell us about the journey.
I'm of an age when women would not have been ordained as rabbis in my childhood, and I do have a very old recollection of being patted on the head and being told, "Well, such a smart little kid. Too bad you're not a boy. You could be a rabbi." And I'm thinking, I'm not sure what that means, but it doesn't exactly sound like a compliment. It took me a while to figure out that what it meant was that if I wanted to do the kinds of things the gentleman on the bima, on the leading worship, would do, that I was the wrong sex to do that. And I had always been drawn to Jewish study. I gave some thought after I finished graduate school in medieval English literature to applying to the Reform Seminary, which had begun ordaining women in 1972. Actually, today is the anniversary of the ordination of the first woman, Sally Priesand, by the Reform Seminary. Just noticed that this morning in the NNO. So that's mazel tov to Rabbi Priesand, who's actually had her complete career and retired from her congregation. I asked and was told, "Oh, no, you're much too old." I was about 30, 31. And I said, "Oh, okay, then I guess this is just not what I'm supposed to do." And I just had not grown up in a liberal Jewish environment. I was in a kind of conservadox environment. And that aspiration seemed off limits. After my husband and I were married, we became involved with Reform congregations precisely because we had a daughter and we wanted her to grow up, now that women were being ordained, not necessarily so that she'd grow up and be a rabbi, but that so she would know that there is no path within our faith that she could not choose to follow if she wanted to. And it stayed in the back of my mind that wouldn't it be nice if I could, but there didn't seem to be an easy path to it. So I went through a couple of iterations of different career paths. I'm a lapsed academic. I ran a communication skills training and consulting business for about 15 years, did some software development, and then found out quite providentially, after I had taken a part-time position at Temple Beth Or as program director, that the Jewish Renewal Movement had a seminary. And I immediately called them in Philadelphia because I had been reading much of the teachings of the leaders in the Renewal Movement and felt very close to their form of understanding Judaism and of teaching deep ecumenism, which was already important to me. And I called and said, I want an application. And they sent it, and I was accepted.
Glad they did. Glad you did. And I'm very happy to talk with you, Rabbi Jurevich. So good to talk with you. Thank you very much. Rabbi Raquel Jurevich, spiritual leader of Yavna, a Jewish renewal community in Raleigh. And that's our program for today. Thank you for listening to The State of Things. Go to our website, stateofthings.org, for more information. Our program directed by Alex Granados, produced by Isaac Davy Aronson and Sean Wen, interns Mark Haywood and Adija Manley. Robin Copley, the technical director, Brent Wolf, our news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.